This program is brought to you by PLI, the Practicing Law Institute. To learn more about this podcast, visit pli.edu/pro bono podcast.
There is a kind of pro bono that works to ensure the American vision. The vision that voting is a fundamental right and that we want every eligible voter to participate. That kind of pro bono directly confronts the reality that the United States has rarely, maybe even never, lived up to the vision of full voter participation. The reality that state governments have burdened voting, especially voting by Black, Latinx, Asian, and Native people. And they have done it over and over and over again. That kind of pro bono came calling for Ezra Rosenberg in 2012, and it changed his career.
I got a call from the pro bono partner who said, we'd like to do a voting rights case. And I said, sure. And it turned out to be the Texas photo ID case, and that's really how it began.
Welcome to Pursuing Justice, the Pro Bono Files, a podcast from PLI, the Practicing Law Institute. We are here to tell pro bono stories, stories that we hope inspire you to take your own pro bono legal work to the next level. I'm your host, Alicia Aiken. I've worked in civil rights, criminal defense, and civil legal aid, but now I'm a principal at the Danu Center for Strategic Advocacy and a faculty fellow at PLI. And I love getting to talk with volunteer lawyers and nonprofit legal projects around the country about the pro bono work that matters to them. I hope you enjoy these conversations as much as I do. In 2011, the Texas legislature made it a priority to pass the strictest voter ID law in the country, known as SB 14. Now, for many people, the idea of showing photo ID when you vote seems reasonable. You often hear reasoning like, well, you need a photo ID to fly, why not one to vote? In the context of SB 14, that analogy falls apart pretty quickly, because SB 14 imposed much stricter limits on the exercise of the right to vote than the TSA imposes on the luxury of flying. For instance, TSA accepts any state's photo ID card. SB 14 accepted only state IDs from Texas. TSA accepts photo ID issued by tribal nations. SB 14 did not. TSA accepts licenses expired up to a year. SB 14 only accepted them within 60 days. TSA allows you to prove your identity in alternate ways at the airport. SB 14 required those without photo ID to spend time and money to get a special election certificate in advance. So maybe what we really should be saying is, gosh, under SB 14, it's easier to clear TSA security than it is to vote in Texas. That doesn't seem right. Many people agreed that Texas's SB 14 did not seem right. Back in 2011, the Federal Voting Rights Act had Section 5, known as the preclearance provision. Now, under preclearance, states that had a proven history of race-based discrimination against voters were required to have any changes to voting law pre-cleared by the U.S. Department of Justice. To obtain preclearance, Texas had to show that SB 14 had neither the purpose nor the effect of denying or abridging the right to vote on account of race, color, or membership in a language minority group. In 2012, the U.S. Attorney General reviewed SB 14 and concluded Texas had not made the required showing. Texas, in fact, had predicted the attorney general would reject SB 14, and the state had already filed a suit requesting that a three-judge panel of the D.C. District Court grant pre-clearance. And that is where our pro bono lawyer, Ezra Rosenberg, came in. Let's get to know Ezra a little bit before we pick up the thread of the SB 14 litigation. Ezra, you have a long and illustrious career.
It's long, I'll tell you that. I'm not sure how illustrious. It's somewhat checkered for a civil rights lawyer. I started my career in New Jersey, where after clerking in the appellate division, I worked for the public defender's office. I did that for 3 years, and quite frankly, I thought I was going to do that the rest of my career.
But life takes all of us in unexpected directions. Ezra spent some time doing environmental law for the Department of Justice Lands Division. Then he joined a small firm in New Jersey, and that firm grew and eventually merged with another firm. And then...
when I actually got a call from Deckert, which was a large global firm, asking me to join them, and I did, and I stayed there for 20 years, loved it.
What kind of law did you do at Deckert?
Primarily, it was a general corporate litigation defense, and I was co-head of the Mass Torts Products Liability Group of Deckert while I was there.
I can imagine that those kinds of large, dare I say, sprawling cases may have been good training for the work that you have ended up doing.
It actually goes beyond that, because one of the things that those types of clients did, because these were cases that were nationwide and they would be sued in different places for the same sorts of things, they really depended on the firms to help them create virtual law firms. That is, taking a partner from Deckard and a partner from Latham and a partner from Goodwin and basically saying, you all have to work together well in the sandbox. And I found that kind of training and skills to be really, really important for what I did when I started to do pro bono work with the Lawyers Committee.
Ezra's pro bono work with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law started because after 38 years of practicing law, he made a big decision about the rest of his career. And that happened in 2012.
I was about 5 years away from when I knew I was going to be retiring. And I went to the head of the firm and I said, I really want to kind of get back to my roots. Because quite frankly, I never thought I'd be working for a big firm. I thought I'd be basically doing public defender sort of work for my life. And I wanted to devote at least half of my time doing pro bono work. And within a day, I got a call from the pro bono partner who said, we'd like to do a voting rights case. And I said, sure. And it turned out to be the Texas photo ID case. And that's really how it began.
When you got that phone call and they said, would you work on a voting rights case? Were you just in a, I'm going to say yes to anything space? Or was there something about voting rights?
I mean, realistic, as I said, I'd done a whole different sorts of pro bono work. And voting rights clearly appealed to me. Well, first of all, it was something I hadn't done before. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I really understood how important it was. So I thought it was an exciting opportunity. When I first got the call from the Deckard pro bono partner asking me if I wanted to do a voting rights case, she directed me to talk with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law and the Brennan Center of Justice, who were partnering on this case, representing the Texas NAACP and the Mexican American Legislative Caucus of the Texas House of Representatives. I had not heard of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. And what I learned about it was astounding, because I hadn't realized it has this just tremendous history. It was actually founded by President Kennedy in 1963 at the suggestion of his brother, Attorney General Robert Kennedy. President Kennedy called into the East Room of the White House about 250 members of the private bar and sat them down and said, it's about time you start to do pro bono civil rights law. And as a result of that, a small group created the Lawyers Committee. That's why it has this weird name, Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law. Only lawyers could come up with that. And the idea was to create a staff who would be handling civil rights cases and leverage the staff with the resources and talents of the private bar. And that's been the model of the Lawyers Committee since then.
And why did the Lawyers Committee need Ezra's help at that moment in 2012? It was the Texas suit to the D.C. District Court requesting preclearance for SB 14's super strict voter ID law. On behalf of its clients, the Lawyers Committee had been granted the right to intervene and participate in the case.
The Attorney General refused, and it was called pre-clearing, the pre-clearance, that was what the approval was called. The Attorney General declined to pre-clear Texas's new requirements because it felt that it had what was called a retrogressive impact on the rights of Black and Latinx voters. And by retrogressive meaning, it made things worse. So Texas sued, and the case was tried before a three-judge panel in the United States District Court. And we intervened on behalf of Texas NAACP and the Mexican American Legislative Caucus, together with other groups who were representing their in different constituencies.
In that case, Ezra was able to assist in the week-long trial where testimony was taken from 20 witnesses. That litigation, it was on a warp speed schedule. I mean, it went to trial about 6 months after it was filed. So getting it done required the effort of many, many lawyers. When Ezra agreed to sit down with us for an interview about his experience, he made sure we also included his colleague, Ryan Haygood, who worked on the SB 14 litigation when he was with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, which had intervened on behalf of its clients.
I'm Ryan Haygood. I lead the New Jersey Institute for Social Justice. We're a legal advocacy organization that uses community organizing, public policy, and litigation to affect systems change in New Jersey. It was in high school that I thought to myself, I want to do what Thurgood Marshall did. Mm-hmm. So fast forward some years in law school, I apply for an internship with the Legal Defense Fund, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, Thurgood Marshall's organization, and I get the internship to work at Thurgood's organization. And while there at LDF for that summer, I learned about a fellowship. It's a four-year relationship between a law firm called Freed Frank and LDF. Mm-hmm. And you spend the first 2 years at the law firm essentially learning how to lawyer, learning about the architecture of litigation. And the idea is that those 2 years, though you're doing corporate litigation or corporate deals, you learn skills that will be transferable in the nonprofit civil rights context. And so I was at Freed Frank for 2 years. Those 2 years at the law firm, I'm incredibly grateful for those. You know, those taught me a lot. And then I came to the Legal Defense Fund as a junior lawyer.
Was there a certain kind of case that you focused in on at LDF, or was it everything?
You are sort of staffed in the area where there's the greatest need at that time. So I was staffed in the voting rights practice. And I'll say candidly, I really wanted to do education work. So if I gave you my least favorite area of the law, it would have been voting. And I couldn't have been more wrong. I grew to love and even think that voting is probably the most important aspect of the work.
That's where you and I first met.
Mm-hmm.
That case went to trial and we won. When I say we, the Department of Justice and the interveners won. The court refused to pre-clear the Texas photo ID law, and Texas appealed.
Specifically, the D.C. District Court panel found that the law would almost certainly have a retrogressive effect because it imposes strict, unforgiving burdens on the poor, and racial minorities in Texas are disproportionately likely to live in poverty. Texas appealed, hoping to get a different outcome. But they actually escaped the effect of Section 5 because of an entirely different case.
While that appeal was pending, the United States Supreme Court issued its opinion in Shelby County versus Holder, which eviscerated Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act.
holding that it essentially that, that the its reenactment in 2006, a reenactment that was what was passed by a vote of 98-0 in the Senate, that there was not enough support in the legislative record to justify the reenactment. Outrageous decision. Basically, it said that the coverage formula that was in place and subjected certain states to Section 5 was no longer valid. The same day that decision came out, the Attorney General of Texas at the time, Greg Abbott, immediately announced that he was now implementing the new Texas voter ID law. As a result of that, all of the organizations that had been involved in, most of the organizations, I should say, that had been involved in the Section 5 case had to file suit under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which puts the burden on the plaintiffs to prove that a voting rights or voting policy or practice denies an equal opportunity to persons of color in voting. And that led to the case that Ryan and I tried together down in Corpus Christi in 2014.
So you all have to start over. How did that feel?
Like Sisyphus, you know, rolling the boulder up the mountain only to have it come down again, which unfortunately is something that we do feel from time to time. But look, we knew that it just had to be done. The decision in Shelby is really one of the, it's hard to explain how bad that decision is and the havoc that it has wreaked. Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act really worked. Justice Ginsburg, in her dissent in Shelby, criticized the majority opinion saying that Section 5 isn't necessary anymore, which is one of the things that Chief Justice Roberts said. He said, look, the world has changed. The country has changed. Things are better. And Justice Ginsburg said, that's like saying that you could throw away your umbrella because it had been stopping you from getting wet.
Yep.
I mean, I say another word might be, you know, vindicated. You know, I think we knew in the absence of Section 5 that states would seek to advance discriminatory voting measures. Texas was a great example. I mean, to Ezra's point, part of why the Section 5 court blocked their photo ID measure was precisely because it was found to be discriminatory.
County decision eliminated Section 5 preclearance completely. The Voting Rights Act provided another possible remedy, known as Section 2. But Section 2 put the burden of proof on plaintiffs. So I asked Ryan and Ezra to explain how their team went about showing that the strict voter ID law was in fact discriminatory.
So the context of Texas's passage of its law is important. You know, it was in response to what the 2010 census showed, which is that the vast majority of Texas's growth was fueled by Black and brown people. And Texas had a fear about the impact of the new voters from the Black and brown communities impacting the outcome of elections in Texas. And so they passed one of the most restrictive photo IDs in the country as part of their effort to stop these potentially newly enfranchised Black and brown people from participating in their electoral process.
So, okay, so help me out here for a listener who really isn't steeped in these issues. So, first of all, how do we know that the Texas legislature was afraid of the impact of Black and brown voters?
You know, as the courts have even said that, you know, nowadays legislators are savvy enough not to expressly say that they're discriminating. So what the courts have allowed us to do is to prove by circumstantial evidence that certain things might be done with discriminatory intent. Mm-hmm. And that includes things like whether there are deviations from how proceedings usually go, or whether things just don't seem right substantively. It's as Ryan says, it's the entire context that you take into consideration, and it includes the history of discrimination in the particular jurisdiction. So you basically piece together the story based on circumstantial evidence, and that's what we've done in Texas.
They were able to show that Texas has a very long and detailed history of blocking voting by non-whites. In fact, Texas was found to violate the Voting Rights Act with racially gerrymandered districts in every redistricting cycle between 1970 and 2014. Texas has racially polarized voting in 252 of 254 counties, meaning that you can reliably predict how a person will vote just by knowing what race they are. When the SB 14 voter ID law was brought to the legislature in 2011, the governor called passing it an emergency. And the Texas Senate made exceptions to its usual procedures to make it easier to push the law through, exceptions that over the prior 30 years had only been made for redistricting and voter ID bills. And what would have been the effect of the strict voter ID bill on actual voters?
I think the number of folks impacted were 600,000 registered voters. I think 8% of them were Black, 6% were Latino. And so we knew, sort of as intended, over the historical arc, that the modern day, the present day impact would be borne disproportionately by Black and Brown voters.
Part of what we proved along the lines of Ryan's saying is that Black and Latino voters were 2 to 3 times less likely to have the required IDs, and that it was 2 to 3 times more difficult for them to get it because you had to go to motor vehicle stations, for example. And that's much tougher for people who have hourly jobs, who are tied to a specific schedule, who don't have mass transportation. And Texas is not the greatest state with mass transportation. It's a huge state. I think that there are at least 1/3 of the counties in Texas that don't even have a motor vehicle headquarters.
Right.
So you know, those were the sorts of things we had to prove. And you know, when Ryan refers to the justification, and actually just you know, something else when Ryan was talking that made me think, you know, poll taxes and literacy tests and all white primaries, those are on their face. Mm-hmm. You can tell they're really discriminatory. But what has happened over time is that those who are intending to discriminate against voters of color use more subtle means. Mm-hmm. And it's such as, ID. You need an ID to get into virtually any office building these days. You need an ID to get onto a plane. So what's the big deal?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, the big deal is, number one, the nature of the ID, and number two, who has it, and number three, that you're stopping people from voting,
right,
which is the single most important right that people have.
And the court agreed. The Southern District of Texas found both discriminatory impact and discriminatory intent. You can find a link to the decision in the show notes. And I promise you, despite being a constitutional decision about voting rights, it is very easy to understand. But Texas was committed to this law, so they appealed to the Fifth Circuit. You may be wondering what Texas said about the law and why it was so important to implement. Texas claimed it needed the strictest photo ID law in the nation to prevent in-person voter impersonation fraud.
We argued that this, you know, that this photo ID measure was sort of the latest iteration of a line of sort of voter suppression tactics advanced by the state, offering as the rationale in each case the need to protect against voter fraud. So at trial, you know, we had experts who went back to look at, for example, Texas's all-white primaries, which was something that they use in the past, and they identified the need to have all-white primaries as a way to prevent voter fraud. You know, Texas had secret ballot provisions, and they said they needed those to protect against voter fraud. Texas also had poll taxes. They argued that they needed poll taxes as a means to protect against voter fraud. Texas had literacy requirements and literacy tests, right? All these measures over the arc of Texas's history, they said they needed to protect against voter fraud, and the latest version of those historical sort of voter suppression tactics was the photo ID measure. It was a very restrictive photo ID measure. And it had a precise impact on Black and brown voters.
And then when they go ahead and say, oh, but we have to stop fraud, and then you realize that in the 10 years leading up to the enactment of Texas's restrictive voter ID law, out of something like, I think it was 20 million votes that had been cast, they came up with only two examples of in-person voter fraud. And remember, voter ID only stops in-person voter fraud. People who are coming into a polling place where there are election officials, out of the 20 million votes that have been cast in the 10 years leading up to the enactment of SB 14, there were only two cases, two out of 20 million. Yet for that, they're willing to disenfranchise tens of thousands of Black and Latino voters.
Yeah. And people will say, well, you know, you're gonna spend a fortune litigating this case, incredible human resource hours committed to it. Why not just encourage folks to get the photo ID? The first question, though, really is interrogate, where's the law coming from? Mm-hmm. Like, why is Texas restricting the number of IDs that it now allows to be used, to Ezra's point, in the absence of a record to support justifying making it harder to get access to the new photo ID measure? And Texas never answered that question except to identify something that had over time had been debunked as a racially discriminatory pretext. But then the second one, to Ezra's point, is it's not that easy. You have to have underlying documents that help you get the ID Texas now requires. Very often it requires birth certificates. And we had a bunch of witnesses who testified about the incredible burden to secure a birth certificate. You know, there was one person who testified that getting a birth certificate would cost her $42 that she didn't have. And she would literally have to make a decision as between the birth certificate and groceries. And she testified that she and her family couldn't eat a birth certificate. And so she made the decision to feed her family. Those kinds of decisions, when someone is forced to make those kinds of decisions, the question is why? And Texas couldn't answer the question in a way that satisfied the judge or anybody, frankly, as to why that was a new requirement Texas was imposing. There was another witness who was a student, Imani Clark, who had previously voted using her student ID and who now couldn't use her student ID, but could use, for example, a concealed handgun license if she could get one. And again, Texas couldn't proffer a meaningful explanation about the tightening of these requirements that impacted her ability to vote.
You know, and the story that Ryan referred to of the woman who said, you can't eat your birth certificate, there were laws or policies in place in several of the southern states that prohibited Black people from giving birth in hospitals. Mm. So they didn't have birth certificates. And this woman was one of those women, one of those people who had been born outside of a hospital. Yeah. Did not have a birth certificate. And again, this is another reason why this law was falling disproportionately on people of color.
And it seems like it really burdens students who have come from out of state, because why on earth an Illinois or a Kansas license isn't useful in preventing voter impersonation? Did they ever explain or address even that question, why other states' IDs are unacceptable?
No, they never did, because it's not justifiable.
Right.
It really is not.
Right.
Well, what was striking about Texas is there was not a meaningful justification for the restrictive nature of the kind of ID you needed to produce. There's so many ways for Ryan Haygood to show that I am who I say I am, including a utility bill or a student ID or a bank card or something. There's lots of ways for me to show that in a way that's not burdensome and for you to be satisfied that I am who I say I am. But when Texas began to restrict the number of IDs required to six from a bigger number, Texas never proffered a reason for doing so. And we knew, given what the census showed, that Texas was responding to a substantial increase in the number of Black and Latino people in their state. And they were worried about what that might mean for the future of their democracy. Look, for people like us, you know, expanding democracy to include new voices as reflected in the census, where there's a growth in our state, is an exciting aspect of what democracy means into the future.
These are the facts and context that Ezra, Ryan, and their 20-plus co-counsel presented in the Section 2 trial in front of the Federal District Court in Texas. That second trial took at least 9 days and had 50 witnesses.
There was not a minute, literally not a minute of downtime, because the court was held sessions from, I think we got there at 8:30 in the morning, and Judge Ramos, he went until 5:30, 6, 6, sometimes even past that, every day.
So that's a lot of coordination in a profession that's been described as herding cats.
Yes. Well, it goes back to the learning how to play well in the sandbox that I mentioned before. Mm-hmm.
How did you feel about Judge Ramos's written decision? What was it, and how did you feel about it?
It was an extraordinarily careful, thoroughly thought out, completely substantiated decision.
She saw the Texas photo ID measure for what it was, you know, an unconstitutional poll tax, among other things. And it was important for us, you know, I think about the collective us, in light of what happened with Section 5, to show that although another provision of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, which we used, among other tools, Section 2 is not a replacement for what we lost in Section 5, but it could also provide strong medicine for the kind of racial discrimination that we were fighting in it.
Under Section 2, you could prove it either by showing discriminatory effect or discriminatory intent. And she found both. And that went up on appeal. I'll try to summarize it briefly. Texas appeals go to the Fifth Circuit, which is a relatively conservative circuit. The three-judge panel affirms Judge Ramos's decision. Texas then asked the entire Fifth Circuit, which is called an en banc review, to take the case. They take the case. That en banc panel, which again is a very conservative panel, again affirms Judge Ramos's finding that there was discriminatory effect under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, reverses her on discriminatory intent because they say that she considered certain evidence that was not relevant, but said there was enough evidence to support an intentional discrimination finding, and therefore we're remanding it to Judge Ramos to reconsider it without the evidence she should not have considered, and directed that there be an interim remedy put into place immediately. Mm-hmm. We then went back to the trial court, and we negotiated with the state and the court's approval an interim remedy, which provided that anyone could vote, even if they didn't have required IDs, so long as they executed a declaration of what reasonable impediment saying they couldn't get it. And that allowed people to vote in the next elections. In the meantime, Judge Ramos reheard the discriminatory intent claim, found that there was discriminatory intent. Texas then appealed that, and the Fifth Circuit then said, by then, Texas had passed a new law that essentially put into law our interim remedy, which allowed people to vote if they executed a declaration of reasonable impediment. And on that basis, the court said, you've gotten the remedy you could get, even if there was a discriminatory intent finding, case is over. And that is what happened.
If you're keeping score, the SB 14 voter ID law was evaluated by federal courts 6 separate times and found to have discriminatory impact or intent every single time. This was a huge project and one that Ezra clearly felt passionate about. So what was the long-term impact on Ezra of having worked on the Texas voter ID case? Ezra, is it fair to say that this pro bono work changed your life?
Oh, that's an understatement. I really never thought, after I had, you know, left the public interest sector earlier in my career, and whatever weird twists and turns my career took after that, I never thought that I would be able to be so fortunate to be able to be doing what I do day in, day out, as I am now. When it came time for me to retire, and my wife kind of suggested in no uncertain terms that there's no way I'm just going to be sitting home and relaxing, and suggested to you, yeah, maybe you should be doing something with whatever talents you have remaining. I talked to the lawyers committee, and they actually asked me if I would be interested in working for them full time. And I said, yes. And I've been doing that for now 9.5 years. I co-direct the Voting Rights Project together with Marcia Johnson, who deals with the programmatic aspects. And I deal with the litigation aspects. We have about 10 lawyers now who we supervise, and doing any major issues relating to voting rights with an emphasis on those cases that further our mission of protecting the rights of Black voters and other voters of color.
I love that you call that your retirement.
Yeah, I'm actually working harder now than I have did in private practice.
I'm
really loving it.
You know, I have been practicing law for 22 years now, and I often get asked, particularly from law students or younger lawyers, you know, what's the key to being like a great lawyer? You know, it's a question. So loaded. There's a lot of things you could describe, like obviously around dogged preparation and what that looks like. But I think the most important thing I lift up is the ability to create meaningful relationships that endure beyond a moment, right? So Ezra and I meet more than 10 years ago in the context of a Section 5 litigation, and couldn't have known at that time what our relationship would look like these many years later, where we become dear friends and are in contact.
I feel the same way. I just consider myself lucky. To have met Ryan.
And so I think for the listeners, right, the challenges we face require a broad cross-section of people who are on the right side of history to use their resources, human and other resources, to join this fight. So there might be a law firm partner listening, like Ezra, who's thinking about how to make a deeper impact, who might be inclined to petition colleagues at the firm to dedicate more time or some time, depending on where the firm is, to joining organizations like the Lawyers Committee or LDF or ACLU or MALDEF in this fight. There may be a junior associate somewhere who's really unhappy with the firm's commitment to these issues and who begins a push internally. And I think that's the real promise of this kind of conversation.
I think the most fulfilling part of my career right now is the having experience to work with much less experienced attorneys and help mentor them. Just the past couple of weeks, we were down at a trial in Mississippi where three of the lawyers on my staff who had never been on their feet in a trial, each had an opportunity to take a significant role in a very important trial. To me, one of the most gratifying things is to be able to help contribute to be building the next generation of civil rights attorneys.
Do you think you could look at people and easily sort of categorize them and sort of where they'll be and what their career will look like? But very often it just takes a spark, a conversation to push institutions in the direction that ultimately helps us shape where the country heads on a broader scale. And that's the real promise of this, both this moment and the opportunity for this kind of work together.
The fact is, for better or for worse, and I guess this is for worse, we've been worse off than we are today. And if people had not fought the way they fought when things were as bad as they were, we would not have made anywhere near the progress that we made. And this, even though we may be disappointed or feel that we have a Sisyphean task, the fact of the matter is there's the worst thing you could do is stop fighting. Mm-hmm. And the only thing you can do is keep fighting. And you sometimes advance by baby steps. Sometimes you advance with large strides. But I really do believe that Dr. King was right when he talked about the arc of the moral universe being long, but pointing to justice. Even in the short run, if you help one person to vote who otherwise would not have been able to vote, that's really a huge thing.
Ensuring eligible citizens have real access to voting is something on everyone's minds as we head into a major election year. I'm just so grateful to Ezra Rosenberg and Ryan Haygood for taking time out of their very full schedules to reflect on their work in the Texas voter ID cases a decade ago. And I'm hoping they inspired you to think about what contribution you can make to fulfilling the American vision of full voter participation in our democratic system.
Thanks for listening to Pursuing Justice, The Pro Bono Files, a podcast from PLI, the Practicing Law Institute. This production is dedicated to the pro bono and public interest lawyers working to improve access to justice. A special thanks goes to our producer, Daniel Pinitz, as well as our host, Alicia Aiken. Please note that the views and opinions expressed during this podcast represent those of the individuals being interviewed and not necessarily those of PLI. PLI is a nonprofit learning organization dedicated to keeping attorneys and other professionals at the forefront of knowledge and expertise. For more information about PLI's wide-ranging curriculum of pro bono programs, visit pli.edu/pro bono.